Welcome to our podcast. I'm Frank Long, Editorial Director of Rehab Management. On this program, I'm welcoming back compliance expert Nancy Beckley of Nancy Beckley & Associates for an update to our longest-running podcast. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Frank. It's good to be back.
Compliance is always an important topic, and we've been accustomed to you bringing our listeners the hottest topics of each year. Let's kick off this podcast by having you give us an overview of the hottest topics.
Here we are in 2018. Like I said, it's good to be back. And let's get straight to your question. There's no shortage of compliance hot topics, and I guess I seem to say that every year. But as we head to the end of 2018 and into 2019 for therapy practices, there are some hot topics, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's start with, though, even though the therapy cap was permanently eliminated by the Bipartisan Budget Act in February of 2018, and can you imagine, we had a lobby for 20 years to get rid of it, and it finally happened, CMS is still requiring a KX modifier for therapy over what's now being called the $2010 threshold, rather than the $2010 therapy cap. Then the next thing is CMS changed its medical review program in October of 2017 to a process called Targeted Probe and Educate. And this has started a new round of topics for outpatient therapy, regardless of the setting. Then the next hot area is the digital age has brought us great opportunity, for example, in telehealth and in patient engagement. But the use of social media has outpaced most therapy practices' ability to have a good, solid social media policy in place. Probably the hottest compliance topic, based upon the investigation work that I do, is not complying with Medicare rules and regulations. And sadly, in most instances, it is because the practice or department is not aware of the regulations or is not aware of recent updates in the regulations.
Nancy, you mentioned a new round of audits targeting outpatient therapy. Is there anything new with these audits? Why are they targeting therapy? And are there trends in who is targeted?
Wow. You know, each year the Medicare administrative contractor comes up with different probe ideas. Additionally, when we had the therapy caps exceptions process, they were targeting therapy to look at that. Then when there was the $3,700 manual medical review, the RACs were reviewing us, and then the MACs were reviewing us, and there was always seeming to be just a lot of problems. Now CMS has started a targeted probe and education process. Each Medicare administrative contractor, or MAC, is going to conduct data analytics to determine which topic areas to probe. And I've seen the following so far in therapy. One MAC is probing primarily for utilization of codes 97530 and 97110. For example, therapeutic activities and therapeutic exercise. And there's some hybrid comparisons. For example, therapeutic activities paired up with manual therapy, which means that the claim had to have a CCI added on if both were billed to indicate they were done in separate and distinct time frames. The targeted probe and educate letters generally state the reason for selection and indicate a provider's statistics or utilization as compared to their peers. Peers, for example, are generally taken to be from within your state. Other targeted probe and educate topics from around the MAC that I've been working with include 97163, which is the physical therapy high complexity evaluation code, and then also a general medical necessity review. In other words, the review is not to take a look at a specific code, but to take a look at the care that was provided on that day was medically necessary. And how it starts out is the contractor or the MAC is going to call the practice or the hospital, whoever it may be, and ask for clarification on the point person for the audit, the targeted probe and educate review. Shortly thereafter, a letter is sent outlining the targeted probe and educate process and indicating why the provider was selected. And they make it sound real cheery, Frank. They make it sound like, you know, it's a big selection, like you've won the publisher's clearinghouse. Well, this is followed by the formal request for the ADR reviews for the claims. And this is generally a prepayment review process, although it can be done on a post-payment review. So after a practice submits a claim and it is not paid, they will get a reason for non-payment is that they need additional information in order to process the claim. And that normally signals that this is one of the 20 to 40 claims that have been selected for the targeted probe and educate review.
Well, Nancy, what tips can you give our listeners to prepare for the targeted probe and educate audit?
Well, Frank, I have been in a number of targeted probe and educate process right now with various clients for many, many different MACs, and I could go on and on about the tips. But first and foremost, I'm going to start with the very basics. Number one, have a copy of the Medicare Benefits Policy Manual, Chapter 15. The rehab section is Section 220 to 230. And also have a copy of the Medicare Claims Processing Manual, Chapter 5. And that's all about therapy billing. And it's also essential to have a copy of your MAC's local coverage determination. Some therapy providers that I speak with don't know or aren't aware of what a local coverage determination is and haven't really kept up to date with any potential changes or concern in the Medicare Benefits Policy Manual or the Claims Processing Manual. Plus, there's a number of other documents that CMS publishes that may be incorporated into your MAC's LCD. I will mention, for example, that Noridian and WPS, they're both Medicare Administrative Contractors, both of these have retired their local coverage determinations. So a therapist can't go and say, what are they expecting at this review? So the next best option is to review their contractor, Noridian or WPS, review the therapy page on their website, as well as any other educational programs that are accessible in their education and training tab on their website. And both Noridian and WPS do have documents and have published a lot of material, so you'll want to avail yourself of those. If you're with Novitas, NGS, CGS, Palmetto, or First Coast, you can pick up a copy of their therapy LCD from their medical policy tab. And it's important to note that some therapy LCDs include PT, OT, and speech, and some of them have separated them out. For example, just PT and OT and then a separate speech. And some have PT, OT, and speech as separate policies. So that's tip number one. You have to understand the rules and the regulations and the checklist of everything that you've sent in and understand what they're going to be using to review you. Secondly, and probably the biggest tip I can give, at this audit is asking for the therapist calendar for the claim date of service that is in the probe. For example, if November 1st is the date of service that they're doing a probe review on, they're going to ask for the therapist calendar for that day. So with people that are on EMRs, that's just usually within your EMR schedule setup. You'll have to print a copy of that. If you're not on an EMR, a copy of your manual character. So it's not unusual, as we all know in therapy, for patients to be double booked or dovetailed, or for that matter, for patients that arrive early or arrive late, which basically messes up what's on the calendar, but the patients still get treated. And I should point out that CMS doesn't require the start time of therapy or the end time of therapy, and many EMR programs allow the front desk to check a patient in. So don't confuse checking a patient in with the start of therapy time, because checking them in could mean that they've just checked in at the front desk and the receptionist just simply noting in the EMR that the patient arrived for therapy. They may be early or late. So generally, when you're taking a look at a therapist's calendar, it may not explain when the patient came, when they started therapy, when they ended therapy, and when they left, or when they were taking rest breaks, for that matter. And if you're submitting documentation for a claim, you want to ensure that the calendar supports the use of the Medicare 8-minute rule guidance. It would appear that the contractors are borrowing a page from the Department of Justice Investigations book and requesting a therapist calendar. A calendar review has been essential in whistleblower investigations of therapy that alleged that one-on-one therapy was billed when the therapy was not delivered on one-on-one. Some people indicate that this is when you should have used group. It's not necessarily that you should have used group therapy. It's that you billed for one-on-one therapy when it wasn't provided. So if you are going to submit your calendar, ensure that when you look at that date of service, the bills that you sent in for that patient are consistent with what your calendar says. And if you dovetailed or double booked, it's fine, but your billing should be consistent with how Medicare directs you to do that in the 11 PTOT billing scenarios document.
Once again, you've mentioned the need to have a compliance program. Nancy, is a compliance plan or compliance program required? And what can a small practice do to develop a compliance program?
Well, Frank, I'm going to put down the rumor mill right now. Compliance programs have been required since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. And even though CMS has not published implementation guidelines, with the exception of skilled nursing facilities, the OIG has advised and consistently advised in their communications and webinars that providers implement a program using the OIG compliance guidance. And in the case of outpatient therapy practices, the document to model a compliance program is the OIG's compliance guidance for physicians in small practices. Although it was written some 18 years ago with the vast majority of the OIG's other compliance guidances, a practice should feel confident using the guidance, conducting a risk assessment, and formalizing a compliance program that is based upon what is called the seven elements. Before I describe the seven elements, I really want to say that we're emphasizing a compliance program, not a compliance plan. The OIG expects to see a living, breathing compliance program, just not a plan. So what are the seven elements of compliance? There's standards, policies, and procedures. That's number one. Compliance program administration. In other words, somebody that's running your program. That's number two. Number three is screening for exclusions. That means people that have not been excluded from federal healthcare programs are safe to use in your practice. If they've been excluded from participation in Medicare, Medicaid, or TRICARE, you may not use those parties in your practice. And if you find out they have been excluded, you might be prompted into a self-disclosure protocol. The next element is communication, education, and training. And that's compliance training and fraud, waste, and abuse training. The next element I call the mother load, which is monitoring, auditing, and reporting. So every practice should be doing chart reviews and monitoring and auditing to ensure that claims were properly submitted, going back to that 8-minute rule again for the number. And then the final one is discipline for noncompliance along with investigations and remedial measures.
Let's talk about policies and procedures for a minute. Are therapy practices required to have policies and procedures? If so, what types of policies and procedures are required? And how can Nancy Beckley and Associates help to get those policies in place?
Well, Frank, a therapy practice should at a minimum have policies and procedures that direct the basics of the practice, administration, clinical, documentation, coding and billing, safety, HIPAA. I've just named a couple of broad areas. And that's for a private practice. I want to start with a rehab agency or a CORF or a hospital. Those are facility-based programs, and those programs are going to have mandatory policies and procedures under the conditions of participation. So that's a little bit of a different scenario. So actually, our private practice sisters and brothers and rehab agencies and CORFs generally have good policies and procedures because they're required to as a condition of participation with Medicare. You move over to private practice and they're considered a supplier to Medicare. So they're not under the conditions of participation. They just have conditions for coverage and conditions for payment. But it's important at a minimum that therapy practices have policies and procedures, as mentioned, that direct the basics of the practice. More and more, we're finding out when people have been under investigation or even under routine audit under the OIG work plan, that the first thing that the Department of Justice or the OIG or the state Medicaid officer might do, because I've been involved with several Medicaid matters, is they say, can we please have your policies and procedures? And practices might have policies and procedures related to, you know, employees, like an employee handbook or personnel policies and procedures, but they may be lacking in essential policies and procedures related to clinical practice or administration, which would include coding and billing and submitting claims. So when you have that outside entity, the investigator, stop at your practice because you're under review or investigation, or even just routine enrollment, for example, with your state Medicaid program, and they ask for to see a copy of your policies and procedures, it's essential that you have something that's going to guide what's going on. And people never really truly realize the importance of policies and procedures till there's a problem. You know, there's a problem with an employee, so they say, show me where your policy says that. Or there's a problem with a third-party payer, or a problem in compliance when you're submitting a claim. So it's really essential. I've written policies and procedures till I'm kind of dizzy and have done so for people that are required to under the conditions of participation. And actually, this past summer, I've essentially taken it upon myself to provide more policies and procedures that are consistent with what might be needed for a small therapy private practice. And I've rolled it up and calling it the essential guide to compliance for the private practice or the small therapy practice. So it's something that I definitely saw a need for in the marketplace. And could a therapy practice do this? Could they dedicate a physical therapist or another clinical professional person to write the policies and procedures? Sure, they could. But very often they're stumped with, what do I need to have? Where do I find out what the regulations are? And then all of a sudden you're looking at it's taking somebody 40 hours of a, you know, professional clinician's time when they could acquire a policy manual for a pittance, so to speak, as compared to the professional time. So I'm offering that service for the first time ever, Frank, and so much appreciate the opportunity to share the compliance issues this year once again, the longest running podcast, like you said, with Rehab Management, and to really talk about the new service that's being offered at nancybeckley.com, and people can access policies at our store. They're all digitally downloaded the second you purchase them.
And there you have it, the hot topics for compliance, directly from compliance expert Nancy Beckley. Nancy, thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. It's been my pleasure.